I'm reading from Epistemic Cultures, How the Sciences Make Knowledge by Karen Noor Satina, copyright 1999. I'm just going to read the introduction. This book is about epistemic cultures, those amalgams of arrangements and mechanisms bonded through affinity, necessity, and historical coincidence, which, in a given field, make up how we know what we know. Epistemic cultures are cultures that create and warrant knowledge, and the premier knowledge institution throughout the world is still science. In this book, I analyze knowledge processes in two sciences. I explore epistemic features, such as the meaning of the empirical, the enactment of object relations, and construction and fashioning of social arrangements within science. Though I analyze science, the notion of epistemic cultures brings into focus the question of knowing in other areas of expertise. By many accounts, contemporary Western societies are becoming, or have already become, knowledge societies. They run on expert processes and expert systems that are epitomized by science, but are structured into all areas of social life. These processes and systems pose questions to the social scientist. How do they work? What principles inform their cognitive and procedural orientations? Can we simply extrapolate from other forms of social order to learn what we need to know about the organization, the structures, the dynamism of knowledge systems? In the landscape of contemporary social science, the functioning of expert systems is by and large an empty space. By examining the notion of epistemic cultures in two sample cases, I hope to provide pointers for drawing the contours of this uncharted area. By taking epistemic cultures as the theme of the book, I am placing emphasis on two problem areas. One concerns our present lack of understanding of the contemporary machineries of knowing, of their depth, and particularly of their diversity. The other concerns the transition of contemporary societies to knowledge societies, of which epistemic cultures are a structural feature. In the next sections, I consider each problem in somewhat more detail. The rest of Chapter 1 briefly discusses culture as practice, and then lays out the structure of the book and the domains of knowledge studied. Section 1, The Disunity of the Sciences. Culture is very likely a permanent feature of the evolution of all human life, yet there is equally likely no one universal human culture, characterizing all human beings in the same generic way at all times and places. The concept of culture is usually used to refer to specific historical forms, such as the state in national culture, the economy in market culture, or the business firm in organizational culture. Cultural specificities arise and thrive, one assumes, when a domain of social life becomes separated from one another, when they curl up upon themselves for a period of time. In other words, they thrive in internally referential systems. For example, domains in which participants orient themselves more towards one another and previous system states than towards the outside. Science and expert systems are obvious candidates for cultural division. They are pursued by groupings of specialists who are separated from other experts by institutional boundaries deeply entrenched in all levels of education, in most research organizations, in career choices, in our general systems of classification. Yet the idea of knowledge-related cultures is not part of our common vocabulary. In the past, terms such as discipline or scientific specialty seem to have captured the differentiation of knowledge. The notion of a discipline and its cognates are indeed important ones in spelling out the organizing principles that assign science and technology to subunits and sub-subunits. But these concepts proved less felicitous in capturing the strategies and policies of knowing that are not codified in textbooks but do inform expert practice. The differentiating systems that we have used in the past were not designed to make visible the complex texture of knowledge as practiced in the deep social spaces of modern institutions. To bring out this texture, one needs to magnify the space of knowledge in action, rather than simply observe disciplines or specialties as organizing structures. The present study is an attempt to enlarge this space. In replacing notions such as discipline or specialty with that of an epistemic culture, I want to amplify the knowledge machineries of contemporary sciences until they display the smear of technical, social, symbolic dimensions of intricate expert systems. The book continues work begun by studies of contemporary scientific laboratories and experiments in the late 1970s, with one difference. Many of the earlier studies were interested in how knowledge is produced in science. They challenged realist explanations of natural scientific knowledge, insisting instead that a social scientific account of science that brought into focus the origin of knowledge in laboratory practice was both warranted and feasible. In this study, I am not interested in the construction of knowledge, but in the construction of the machineries of knowledge construction. This approach should create no further scandal, but it deepens the split with traditional notions of knowledge, magnifying this aspect of science, not its production of knowledge, but its epistemic machinery, reveals the fragmentation of contemporary science. It displays different architectures of empirical approaches, specific constructions of the referent, particular ontologies of instruments, and different social machines. In other words, it brings out the diversity of epistemic cultures. This disunifies the sciences. It runs counter to an assumption generally associated with the work of the Vienna Circle of more than 50 years ago, particularly the argument for the unity of science. The thesis that there is only one kind of knowledge, only one science, and only one scientific method has been challenged in the past on the grounds that the natural scientific approach is not applicable to the human sciences, and their distinct goal of understanding actors' meanings in concrete historical situations. However, few analysts have looked beyond this bifurcation to suspect ontological difference and methodological divergence are also among the natural sciences. Today, this suspicion is more frequently articulated and listened to. Nonetheless, the image of a unified natural science still informs the social sciences and contributes to their dominant theoretical and methodological orientation. The debates raging over realist, pragmatist, skepticist, or perspectival interpretations of science all tend to assume science is a unitary enterprise to which epistemic labels can be applied across the board. The enterprise, however, has a geography of its own. In fact, it is not one enterprise, but many, a whole landscape or market of independent epistemic monopolies producing vastly different products. Two of these monopolies are analyzed in this book. Both are vanguarded sciences at the forefront of academic respectability. Both intense, successful, heavily financed, but both are also differently placed on the map of disciplines. One, experimental high-energy physics, tries to understand the basic components of the universe. Commensurate with the scale of the technology used for this goal, experimental high-energy physics requires a specific form of scientific inquiry, the large transnational collaboration. Besides building up an understanding of the deepest components of the universe, high-energy physics also builds superorganisms. Collectives of physicists matched with collectives of instruments that come as near as one can get to a post-romantic communitarian regime. I compare the communitarian science of physics with the individual, bodily, lab bench science of molecular biology. The contrasts are many. One science, physics, transcends anthropocentric and culture-centric scales of time and space in its organization and work. The other, molecular biology, holds on to them and exploits them. One science is semiological in its preference for sign processing. The other shies away from signs and places the scientist on a par with nonverbal objects. One, again physics, is characterized by a relative loss of the empirical. The other is heavily experimental. One transforms machines into physiological beings. The other transforms organisms into machines. Using a comparative optics as a framework for seeing, one may look at one science through the lens of the other. This visibilizes the invisible. Visibilizes. each pattern detailed in one science serving as a sensor for identifying and mapping equivalent, analog, conflicting patterns in the other. A comparative optics brings out not only the essential features of each field, but differences between the fields. These, I believe, are far more tractable than the essential features. In fact, one might argue that they are the only tractable elements available to us. The present study is a first attempt to address the epistemic disunity of contemporary natural sciences in their machineries of knowing. But this book can also be located in the context of a broader question, one that is more in the background than the first, but nonetheless informs the present work. This is the question of the current transmutation of modernity into new institutional forms, forms interstitched with knowledge systems and processes. Section 2. The cultures of knowledge societies. There is a widespread consensus today that contemporary Western societies are in one sense or another ruled by knowledge and expertise. A proliferation of concepts such as that of a technological society, an information society, a knowledge society, or a risk society, or experimental society, embodies this understanding. The recent source of this awareness is Daniel Bell, for whom the immediate impact of knowledge was its effect on the economy, which resulted in such widespread changes as shifts in the division of labor, the development of specialized occupations, the emergence of new enterprises, and sustained growth. Bell and later commentators also offer a great deal of statistics on the expansion of R&D efforts, R&D personnel, and R&D expenses in Europe and the United States. More recent assessments have not changed this argument so much as added further arenas in which the impact of knowledge is identified. For example, Habermas argued that the life world is technicized through the universal principles of cognitive and technological rationality in his description of the spread of abstract systems to everyday life. Drucker links knowledge to changes in organizational structure, management practices, and education. And Beck, describing ecological risks resulting from the alliance between science and capital, depicts transformations of the political sphere through corporate bodies of science, scientists. He and Crone and Ware also argue that the application of scientific findings before they have been fully explored erases the boundary between the laboratory and society. On a global scale, several authors point out that the power of the nation-state is undermined not only by multinational corporations and a capitalist economy, but also by transnational social units whose ties are based upon technologically usable knowledge. Lash and Uri use the concept of electronic information structures to refer to the arteries of economic production systems that operate on a potentially global scale. Finally, Giddens, who focuses more on the microscale of things, extends the argument to the self and the lifespan, arguing that we live in a world of increased reflexivity mediated by expert systems. Giddens points out that today's individuals engage with the wider environment and with themselves through information produced by specialists, which they routinely interpret and act on in everyday life. The good news about the literature is that it realizes the thick interweaving of professional knowledge and other aspects of social life. The bad news is that the concepts used so far remain eclectic. The authors pay scant attention to the nature of knowledge processes and knowledge cultures, and they tend to see knowledge as an intellectual or a technological product rather than as a production context in its own right. The most consistent and powerful line of reasoning is still that of Bell and his followers, for whom the transition to a knowledge society is essentially an economic dynamic. In a nutshell, the argument is that knowledge, defined, for example, as a set of organized statements of fact or ideas, has become a productive force replacing capital, labor, and natural resources as the central value and wealth-creating factor. According to these ideas, it is knowledge that makes our society post-industrial or post-capitalist, fundamentally changing the nature of production systems, the nature of work, and the demands on the workforce and on work-related items. Among those who consider the role of knowledge in current society more from a sociological rather than an economic angle, it is Giddens who goes furthest in articulating knowledge as a determining factor in what he calls reflexive modernization, a state of modernity based on the reflexive ordering and reordering of social relations in the light of continual inputs of knowledge. Giddens sees society as permeated by expert systems, in quotes, which he defines as, quote, systems of technical accomplishment or professional expertise that organize large areas of the material and social environments in which we live today, end quote. The advantage of the notion of an expert system over some of the other concepts is that it brings into view not only single knowledge products or scientific technical elites, but the presence of whole contexts of expert work. However, Giddens treats these systems much as other theorists treat knowledge in general, in terms of the technological or interpretive output. The systems themselves remain black-boxed. They are alien elements in social arrangements, elements that are best left to their own devices. The received assumption here is that expert systems run on principles having to do with the technical content of expert work and differing from principles manifest in other spheres of social life. These theories of social transformation tend to follow what Dennett calls the design strategy of interpretation in regard to knowledge. From the design stance, one ignores the details of the constitution of a particular domain. On the assumption that the domain is designed to produce a particular outcome, one considers only its output and its particular relevance to one's purposes. Modernization theorists tend not to address the question of how the knowledge process they incorporate into their arguments work, which structures or principles adequately describe this working, or how the notion of knowledge dealt with in these systems ought to be specified. What they are interested in, on the whole, are the transformative effects of those systems' outcomes on other social spheres, on personal life, industrial organization, market expansion, etc. Knowledge contexts retain their aura of difference simply because they remain uninterrogated, as they did until recently, even in the specialty devoted to them in science studies. If the argument about the expanding presence of expert systems and knowledge processes in contemporary Western societies is right, however, the design stance defeats the intention of understanding this particular development. Not only does the expansion of expert systems result in a massive increase in the technological and informational products of knowledge processes, it also amplifies the processes themselves and knowledge-related contexts and structures. A knowledge society is not simply a society of more experts, more technological gadgets, more specialist interpretations. It is a society permeated with knowledge cultures, the whole set of structures and mechanisms that serve knowledge and unfold with its articulation. The traditional definition of a knowledge society puts the emphasis on knowledge seen as statements of scientific belief, as technological application, or perhaps as intellectual property. The definition I advocate switches the emphasis to knowledge as practiced within structures, processes, and environments that make up specific epistemic settings. If the argument about the growth of expert systems is right, what we call society will, to a significant degree, be constituted by such settings. In a knowledge society, exclusive definitions of expert settings and social settings, and their respective cultures, are theoretically no longer adequate. This is why the study of knowledge settings becomes a goal in the attempts to understand not only science and expertise, but also the type of society that runs on knowledge and expertise. Epistemic cultures are the cultures of knowledge settings, and these appear to be a structural feature of knowledge societies. But it would be wrong to understand knowledge societies as homogeneous and one-dimensional, which they are not. The linkage of knowledge and society in one concept conceals the complexity of current transitions and the possible contradictions posed by knowledge and expertise. I cannot, in this context, pursue the various sides of the phenomenon of the knowledge society any further, since it is a matter for a properly detailed analysis in its own right. Epistemic cultures, one must stress, are but one aspect of this phenomenon. While I will come back to the idea of the knowledge society in the final chapter, what I want to do in the rest of the book is to make the idea of epistemic cultures plausible. This can only be done, I assume, by a substantive analysis of such cultures, during which all other issues must be pushed to the sidelines. Okay, section 3, culture and practice. Turning from these general sociological issues back to epistemic cultures, I want to say something about how I understand the notion of culture. Culture, as I use the term, refers to the aggregate patterns and dynamics that are on display in expert practice and that vary in different settings of expertise. Culture, then, refers back to practice in a specific way. To bring out the differences between related ideas, consider how practice has been addressed in earlier studies of expertise. The genre of studies of knowledge that took practice as its organizing theme was created in the late 70s and early 80s. The studies differed widely, but they were united by a common focus on contemporary science as produced in contemporary settings, for example, in scientific laboratories. Contemporary here means observable knowledge processes. Although the focus on science as practice has been extended to historical cases, studied, for example, through laboratory notebooks, the distinctiveness of the approach rested originally on the applicability of direct observation to contemporary knowledge systems. Practice served as a contrasting term for these studies. One investigated scientists at work as opposed to the history of ideas, the structure of scientific theories, or the institutional settings of science. Beyond foregrounding such differences, the notion of practice foregrounded the acts of making knowledge. In other words, practice was interpreted within an action theory framework, or as Pickering calls it, within a performative idiom, referencing Jeffrey Alexander. The action framework helped studies oriented towards scientific practice to bring out the shaping and interweaving features of knowledge work. If one approaches practitioners as actors, one zeroes in on the active, agency-related components of knowledge processes, pushing the results of these processes as they relate to nature out of view. Other things are pushed out of view by an action theory framework, the orientations and preferences that inform whole sequences of action, the structures built from combinations of such sequences, the ways in which actors themselves are configured. The action theory framework offers little purchase for establishing the patterns on which various actions converge and which they instantiate and dynamically extend. It shines the analytic torch upon the strategies and interests and interactional accomplishments of individuals and sometimes groups. While this yields important insights into how agents generate and negotiate certain outcomes, it offers no dividends on the machineries of knowing in which these agents play a part. Practice, of course, can refer also in a more generic way to just those patterned dynamic sequences which are the ingredients of such machineries. This notion of practice shifts the focus away from mental objects, such as the interests and intentions that inform concepts of action, and toward the reordered conditions and dynamics of the chains of action of collective life. If one defines practice in this way, the notion of culture follows. Culture, in this book, foregrounds the machineries of knowing composed of practices. But the notion of culture also adds something to the idea of practice. In the literature, the term culture enjoys a varied range of associations, of which three seem particularly relevant to the present effort. The first is that culture, as already indicated, implies ruptures in any uniformities of practice. These ruptures are important because they suggest the existence of different technologies of knowing, serving different substantive, technological, and economic ends. A second association the term culture sometimes has is that of a certain richness of ongoing events. In this sense, it means a thick growth of variegated patterns piling up on top of one another. Knowledge systems, in particular, appear like density regions of the social world. If knowledge is constructed, it is deeply and intricately constructed, involving multiple instrumental, linguistic, theoretical, organizational, and many other frameworks. Third, culture in recent writings is strongly associated with the symbolic expressive aspects of human behavior. This symbols and meanings conception of culture is best exemplified by Geertz's influential definition of culture as, quote, a historically transmitted pattern of meanings embodied in symbols, a system of inherited conceptions expressed in symbolic form by means of which men communicate, perpetuate, and develop their knowledge about and attitudes towards life, end quote. Today's culture analysts are divided on what the symbolic stuff of culture amounts to: shared beliefs and values, expressive rituals, the meanings expressed in much of our behavior. But most analysts nonetheless remain united in viewing culture as a concept that sensitizes us to the symbolic components of social life, which have been investigated in recent years with growing interest and success. The notion of culture, then, brings to practice a sensitivity for symbols and meaning, a third element that enriches the idea of epistemic machineries. I take the position that signification and the behavioral text of practice cannot be separated, and that views of culture that ignore the conduct of experience are just as limited as views of practice that squeeze symbols out of the picture. In this book, symbolic structurings will come into view through the definition of entities, through systems of classification, through the ways in which epistemic strategy, empirical procedure, and social collaboration are understood in the two fields investigated. I will also briefly return to the meanings of culture in the final chapter. The rest of this first chapter talks about the structure of the book and also introduces the two cases of physics and biology and how all of the data was collected. Talks a bit about all of her methodology, which involved interviews, email correspondence, and they tried to record as much as they could. And I'll just end with her final paragraphs. She says, the culturalist genre of depiction chosen in this book offers an alternative to historical narration, but this is where the second limitation comes into the picture. The present analysis is not, as a survey of culture might be, comprehensive, covering domains from the cosmology to the economic infrastructure. Rather, it is kaleidoscopic. I look at conjunctions of activities by means of a succession of shifts in focus, as someone might turn a kaleidoscope to view various aspects of the empirical machineries, the technological machineries, and the social machineries of two epistemic cultures. There is no pretension that the combination of patterns I discuss somehow adds up to all that could be said about the two sciences' local practices. What more needs to be added? Surely a word about the generalizability and relevance of the results. Take the case of experimental high-energy physics. We study UA2, besides CDF at Fermilab, the most successfully implemented collider experiment in the second half of the 1980s, and we are now studying ATLAS, CERN's presumed flagship experiment for the next generation of Hadron colliders, which, since the superconducting supercollider will not be built, shares the task of exploring the Higgs mechanism with perhaps only one other smaller experiment, its sister experiment, CMS, at CERN. With respect to generalizability, one can bank on the fact that only two experiments worldwide will monopolize the energy range of the LHC. I believe that the analysis presented in Chapter 3 of the liminal and recursive empirical machinery of HEP and of the semiological and theoretical constitution of its data opens a path to other PP experiments. if detectors in these experiments are structurally alike, their analysis, like the analysis of life, in quotes, in molecular biology, should shed light on machine ontologies in other cases. What about the more sociological question of a collaborator's organization? As indicated in chapters 7 and 8, some experiments had strong leaders, for example, UA1 during its first stage. Would this not alter what I said about the present post-romantic communitarian organization of massive collaborators? It might, in some cases. On the other hand, it is unclear how much difference one leader, strong or not, makes in solving the problems of managing 1,500 or 2,000 or more collaborators. One assumes that the disappearance of the individual epistemic subject would be felt by participants, that time would still run on a scale that spans generations of experiments, that the mechanisms holding a collaboration together would still include the discursive and temporal devices I put forward, though they might not be based on the same policies of group formation. Nonetheless, what if the experiments were indeed unique? We could still investigate them, I think, as model systems for the cultures of knowledge societies, much as molecular biologists investigate the fruit fly as a model system for certain aspects of cell differentiation. The use of model systems is not to be sniffed at. Model systems constitute circumscribed environments in which, as in HEP collaborations, reflexivity is turned into an instrument of knowledge. Machines are redefined and recruited into the social world, and the subjectivity of participants is put on the line, and quite successfully replaced by something like distributed cognition. It is precisely such processes, it would seem, which might come to characterize societies that run on knowledge, and HEP experiments offer the captive environments that allows one to study how these work.